Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hanna Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we discuss climate fragility risks in the Arctic region together with Marisol Maddox. She is an analyst at the Polar Institute of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Her research considers the security implications of an opening Arctic with a focus on emerging activist threats such as climate change and biodiversity loss. It also looks at the ways they influence security strategies, geopolitical dynamics, and the broader threat environment. Before we start, we would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording. Hello, Marisol. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
To give our listeners a better impression of the Arctic region, could you please briefly explain the socioeconomic, geographical, and political context of the region?
Sure, yeah. So there are 8 nations with territory in the Arctic. That's Canada, Finland, Denmark by way of Greenland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the United States. And these tend to be more developed countries. And so when looking at regional risk from climate change, while the changes that occur in the Arctic have tremendous implications for the rest of the world, these countries themselves actually are some of the ones that do stand to gain the most relative to other parts of the world. But I would point out here that this is where it's very important to note that if climate change is not mitigated, really the whole world will be likely suffering massive disruption. And so that relative benefit will really be diminished. The total population of the Arctic is around 4 million people, with about an eighth of the population, so about 500,000 people of indigenous background. And a big difference here exists between the North American Arctic and the European Arctic, the latter of which has much greater levels of development, including some fairly cosmopolitan cities, such as Tromsø in the Norwegian Arctic, which sometimes challenges the view of the Arctic as a frozen place where there's just polar bears and not really any people. But there are, you know, thriving economies and all of that. The Arctic has really been exceptional as a region where cooperation has predominated, even during times of tension. And this has largely been led through the work of the Arctic Council, which is the premier intergovernmental forum for the region, and it's a consensus-based body. There's also very productive cooperation through the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. There are changes in the region, though, which we'll be getting into. The way that the region is changing, such as northern maritime routes opening up, you know, this is having an impact on these regional dynamics. And so Russia, for instance, which has a massive Arctic coastline, is increasingly finding it important to be able to realize the economic potential of their Arctic resources, such as oil, gas, mineral deposits, coal, as well as to be able to commercialize the Northern Sea Route. So they've really actually identified this as being so important that it is a matter of national security to them. So that desire to be able to support the realization of that economic potential, as well as the increasingly accessible approach of their northern flank, is also leading them to be militarizing. And so that, of course, has other repercussions, especially post-2014, where after the annexation of Crimea, where there's more concern about Russian aggression.
Thanks so much. I think we will dive deeper into many of those aspects you already mentioned during the podcast. And this was really helpful to actually like understand the Arctic region better and to create kind of an image about it in my head. Because I guess in the collective unconscious thinking of climate change in the Arctic, we always think about this image of a stranded polar bear drifting on melting ice sheets, but there's just so much more about the region itself. Right at the beginning of your climate fragility risk brief, you write about the climate in the region and how tipping points potentially impact all of us. How is the climate in the Arctic and what are tipping points? Moreover, what does that all mean for people all around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, the latest research has revealed the Arctic is now warming at an average of 3 times faster than the global rate of change. And the Arctic sea ice minimum reached its second lowest level on record in 2020. And we're really seeing reality outpacing what models are predicting, which is very concerning in terms of understanding how quickly things are changing and what that means for things like tipping points. So tipping points are basically some abrupt and potentially irreversible change in the threshold of an Earth system, which any additional incremental change can result in a major shift in the state of that system. And so it's kind of like if you think about being in a kayak in the water and you are kind of going back and forth, there's that point at which you're going to just flip over, right? And so that is like the tipping point of the kayak. And so when it comes to Earth systems, it's really not clear yet how much it's possible to overshoot certain thresholds and for how long before that tipping point is breached and the changes could potentially be irreversible. So a few examples where the Arctic heavily influences tipping points are in the stability of the Greenland ice sheet, which basically holds about 7 meters of global sea level in it. So as we're seeing it start to have these major melt events, that's very concerning. There's also the tipping point related to the strength of AMOC, which is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is basically this major ocean system conveyor belt. And the reason that it is weakening is because of this influx of fresh water from all of the ice that's melting because it's such a high volume. And so that has implications for the salinity. And so the warmer water is higher up, right? The colder water sinks. And so those dynamics that allow for this pump to be strong are weakening. And then the other tipping point is around the stability of permafrost. And over 80% of Alaska and over 60% of the Russian Federation are underlaid by permafrost. So as it thaws, there's very significant concerns about implications for critical infrastructure, as well as for the larger contributions of greenhouse gases. Permafrost releases not only carbon dioxide, but also methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. And permafrost thaw is also a source of novel pathogens, which in the era of COVID and all the disruption that we're seeing, that is definitely significant to know that there are these ancient microorganisms that we haven't been exposed to that are potentially being released. And then there's also some very significant deposits of radon and mercury that are also being released. One thing that's very concerning about permafrost and particularly subsea permafrost is that this is new research where we did not previously understand how much methane and carbon was trapped in the subsea permafrost and sediment. So that's actually not figured into climate models, but they found that it's around 60 billion tons of methane and 560 billion tons of carbon. So those are very significant and really do need to be factored into our carbon budget.
That is very interesting in a very sad way. I'm really glad to have you here with us today, getting into these important details. I don't even know where to begin. It's actually shocking that the Arctic is experiencing anthropogenic climate change at 3 times the global rate of change, and also that we have reached this unfortunate milestone with its sea ice minimum having reached its second lowest level on record in 2020, not to mention all the potential risks for health that we can't even know what they are. As we know, risks from climate change, they come not only from its direct impacts, but also, of course, from the way it interacts with other factors to challenge human and civil security, ecosystem health, and of course, very relevant for the Arctic, the geopolitical environment. In your risk brief, you've identified 7 ways in which climate fragility manifests in the Arctic region. Could you get into a little bit more detail?
Absolutely. So the first risk, which I think is really important in terms of categorizing the risk, is this idea of actorless threats playing a much larger role in the threat environment. And so what this basically refers to are things like pandemics, like climate change and biodiversity loss, which are a part of these very complex interactive systems where we don't necessarily appreciate how much they influence stability until they start to fail. And so as we're moving forward and climate change is accelerating, our ability to appreciate the potential for disruption that these forces have is really important for us to be able to correctly identify what the greatest risks are going forward, and also to be able to identify new opportunities for cooperation, which I think could be really great for building productive relationships. The second risk comes from an increase in military activity in the Arctic. This is a natural extension to some extent of the region becoming more accessible, but we currently lack high-level multilateral Arctic security dialogue due to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, which then ended their involvement in the Arctic Security Forces Roundtable and Arctic Chiefs of Defense forums because of the sanctions that were imposed on them. But at the same time, a lot has changed since 2014. And so now we really do need to be having dialogue because we're seeing these higher levels of military activity, increasingly advanced weapons testing, and levels of aggression that we really haven't seen since the Cold War. The third risk is that China is using climate change as a pretext for increasing their engagement in the region. And so through soft power diplomacy, foreign direct investment, scientific research, China is expanding their efforts to gain access, presence, and influence in the Arctic region. And China has a growing interest in extending their military operations in the Arctic. And all of this is more concerning as we're seeing China become increasingly authoritarian. The fourth risk is for indigenous communities, which are disproportionately at risk. They're at the front lines of climate change as landfast ice that has traditionally buffered coastal communities from storms is melting. And then we're also seeing more intense storms where it used to be that the Arctic with cold water was a graveyard for storms. That's how Dr. Jennifer Francis puts it, which I thought was very apt. But instead of becoming a graveyard for storms because the cold would subdue it, with the warming, they're actually becoming reinvigorated. And then there's also issues around, you know, food security, access to essential services, and then disruption of traditions that are really important for cultural identity. So I do want to note that, you know, Arctic indigenous communities have been in the region for thousands of years, and so they are highly adaptive, but the rate of change is unprecedented. And so it's really difficult to adapt under such a short time frame. The fifth risk is a little bit different, but I think that there really is something to this in terms of how we frame the potential for migration to the region. And what I identified as the risk is that basically with Arctic countries having more opportunities for economic development, one of the constraints they commonly identify is a lack of workforce to support that economic development. And so if there is the perception that migration will be a threat to the region because they're people who are not like the people in Arctic countries, that's a risk to them being able to realize the potential of these opportunities and to economically benefit. And so what I'm hoping is that safe and sanctioned migration to the Arctic could potentially be perceived as a key to unlocking the workforce to help Arctic nations realize these new market opportunities. The sixth risk is that a failure to act on climate change in an effective and timely manner may increase the likelihood of a country or just a wealthy individual deploying some type of geoengineering technology. And so that's really something that is not looking at the precautionary principle. These technologies are becoming pretty inexpensive. So it really could just be one person who thinks that, you know, they want to act on this, but they're not understanding, you know, all of the externalities. And the final risk I'd like to mention is that with this increasing economic opportunity in the Arctic, there is definitely interest for transnational organized crime to be opportunistically identifying new sources of revenue for themselves. And so they will seek to leverage the physical and socioeconomic changes to expand their activities, such as exploiting lower levels of oversight in free trade zones and ports.
While there are so many different ways in which climate change impacts the security situation in the Arctic, and what I find striking about the risks you describe is that they really go in so many different directions. And we're talking about everything from biodiversity loss to the risk of pandemics to diplomatic tensions. And it feels like there's barely a type of risk to human security missing from this picture. But particularly concerning is that it also triggers more negative effects in other regions of the world, right? So do you have any examples on how climate change in the Arctic will affect other pathways of climate fragility around the world?
There is already an established connection between Greenland's ice melt and what's been identified as a drastic decrease in West African monsoon precipitation, which directly impacts the already fragile Sahel region. So that's one example. And then there was also a very interesting study that came out earlier this year, which was looking at atmospheric vapor from this major 2018 storm in Europe that was referred to as the Beast from the East. And using this like geochemical thumbprint of the vapor, they tracked the source to the Arctic. And they said that, according to their study, 88% of the snow that fell in Europe during this really significant storm event was linked to long-term decline of Arctic sea ice and the warming of water, particularly in the Barents Sea. So those are two examples of we already have a direct link. And there's also the saying, because of how much sea level rise basically is locked up in Greenland's ice sheet, the Arctic is the fate of Miami. And that's something that is kind of referred to because it's true. You know, these low-lying areas around the world are going to be at higher risk as we are seeing increased melting of the cryosphere all around the world.
I start to understand why the Arctic region is really so important to all of us, regardless of where we are, not only from an environmental, but also from a security perspective. Now, I'm curious to dive deeper into the geopolitical aspects. So what would you say the countries engaged in the region, what do they want to achieve? And how do you see China's presence in the region developing? And do general geopolitical tensions between China and the US factor into this?
All the Arctic countries do want to be able to realize the full potential of new opportunities, you know, such as increased tourism and agriculture and growing the blue bioeconomy, expanded potential of maritime routes and new opportunities that will come there, and also to increase the living conditions for their northern communities so that they can attract the workforce to support these new opportunities. We're seeing a lot of countries that are recognizing the opportunities that are emerging in the Arctic and that want to be involved. And so a great way to appreciate this interest is to look at the Arctic Council. So we have eight Arctic nations, but there's also the opportunity for countries around the world to apply for observer status. And then additionally, they want to be engaging scientifically because of how clear it is that the changes in the Arctic impact the rest of the world. And so for certain countries to be understanding how it's going to impact their monsoon season, for instance, having that type of data collection is a great opportunity to work together. And when it comes to China, it's not about not wanting to work with China. And I think that from a pragmatic perspective, where we're seeing China offering up capital where other countries aren't, that's where their investment becomes more of interest. And so, you know, we saw that with Iceland when they needed to be bailed out after the financial crisis, and they had gone to a bunch of countries first and asked to be bailed out. And it ended up being China that said, oh, okay, we'll come in and we'll offer you this money. And then that led to this development of a relationship such that then China ended up signing a free trade agreement with Iceland, which was their first free trade agreement with a European country. And so you see the way that they will leverage their investments to further their political aims. So one potential interest in the Arctic for China also relates to their second strike capability as a nuclear deterrent, which is very significant. And the revelation recently that this Russian naval officer who had been spying for China and was charged with treason, it was discovered that he had divulged to China Russia's methods of submarine detection. And so the fact that that is what was of interest to China kind of speaks further to the evidence that does support that China's interested in the ability to potentially hide a submarine in the Arctic for that second strike capability.
Now looking into the future. On the climate change side, we know that changes in the Arctic are not confined to the Arctic. So we already talked about the fact that they are of immense consequences to international security and stability. And in your risk brief, you also identify manifold entry points, how governments and policymakers could best address the compound climate fragility risks. Could you please name the most important ones and explain them?
Absolutely. The most important concept for policymakers to understand about the growing role of actorless threats in the threat environment and just the reality that we're going to be facing going forward is that, you know, climate change is not occurring within a vacuum. And climate change, biodiversity loss, you know, water security, food security, all of these are linked. And it's really important to be thinking about how we go about strategizing for stability and security in a way that recognizes that these are parts of complex systems. I think that another really important measure to be taken for continuing the kind of lack of legal vacuum that exists in the Arctic right now. It is a place of stability, but But things are changing. And so we do need to be strengthening governance as it relates to the Arctic and the Arctic Ocean, as we have this new ocean that's emerging. And so with the Arctic Council lacking legal personality, dedicated and transparent funding, they don't have the ability to bind members to decisions. So when we look at ecosystem-based management through the Arctic Ocean, the Arctic Council would have some serious structural issues for being that international regime to achieve that management. And so one option to consider, which had been presented by my colleague, Ambassador David Bolton, is this idea for a creation of a marine science body for the Central Arctic Ocean, like ICES or PISCES, that could fulfill the role of this joint program of scientific research and monitoring that is mandated through the recent agreement that came into force on the Central Arctic Ocean fisheries moratorium. That body could eventually develop some kind of management function similar to OSPAR. And then we really need to be deepening dialogue. Since the sanctions in 2014 precluding military-to-military cooperation, like I mentioned, a lot has changed, and we really need to be renewing dialogue for the sake of stability in the region. And so there's a few options emerging, such as this idea of an Arctic Ocean Naval Symposium that would bring together the chiefs of Arctic navies to discuss maritime security. There's the idea for a code of conduct for Arctic forces that could also help to reduce risk related to the increased military exercises. And there's certain venues, like at the Munich Security Conference, they have the Arctic Security Roundtable, and that already has very high level representation. So that could be leveraged to help to facilitate constructive dialogue. And then in terms of development in the Arctic, you know, we have a real opportunity here to try to get development right as these new markets are emerging, in terms of reducing opportunities for bad actors to exploit the new opportunities. And so having high levels of transparency and accountability, and looking to other places in the world that have developed best practices for countering the influence of bad actors and reducing vulnerabilities is really important. And then I would also say that engaging Indigenous knowledge holders is really important from the beginning in terms of crafting questions and making sure that before we're seeking answers, are we getting the questions right? And I think referring to traditional ecological knowledge and recognizing that these traditional worldviews were conducive and are conducive to longevity just by their very nature. If they're able to be in one place for thousands of years, they clearly get it, right? And so I think that we really have something to learn from Indigenous cultures in terms of how to exist on this earth in a way that is really healthy, and where we're in healthy relationship with each other and with not over-exploiting resources.
Thank you so much for explaining all those points in detail. And beyond the role of climate change as a stressor for the Arctic, but also worldwide, do you think there is potential to utilize climate action and climate adaptation measures in the region as peace-building tools, or as dialogue enablers, and potentially opening the doors to solve other contentious issues in and around the region?
Yes, I absolutely do think that. And I think we're seeing interest from around the world in things like, you know, developing the circular economy, which is really beneficial not only for reducing your carbon footprint, but also for reducing waste. And we've seen that the Arctic really has become a place where we're seeing plastic accumulation from all different parts of the world, and we're seeing atmospheric deposition of nanoplastics. And so if we can be trying to increase the efforts around circular economy opportunities, that's something where we can be cooperating and then also benefiting from that physically as well. And then in terms of scientific research, there's huge opportunities for cooperation around understanding permafrost and how it's changing, and how can we be developing infrastructure in areas where we're seeing massive flux, and just cooperating on science to develop more accurate carbon budgets, like I mentioned with the subsea permafrost. And also we need to be increasing year-round data collection so as to understand seasonal variation, because we tend to have data collection during the warmer months, so we're not totally understanding how do things change throughout the year.
To conclude, I would like to know what you find most fascinating about the region. Where does your research interest come from? What drives you? And what would you like to achieve with your work?
You know, the Arctic is really just such a place of absolutely fascinating convergence of what I find to be the most compelling issues of our time. And I think that it's just making it so clear that the changes that we're seeing are so undeniable, and it challenges us. I think it gives us that push that we need to really understand that the status quo is not okay. And so by doing that, it also kind of allows us, hopefully, to break through some of the barriers that have kind of created inertia around climate change. And so I think that there's some really great opportunities there. And I mean, I love the Arctic field in general. Everybody I've worked with has just been so wonderful. And there's such amazing diversity and culture. And I've learned so much about just different practices in different countries and really gained appreciation for food culture in different countries. So I just really enjoy it both intellectually and then also just as a human being. And I would say that my research is really just an extension of what I feel like is my life's work. And I'll probably be working on this for the rest of my life. It really just comes from a place of so much deep appreciation for this incredible world that we live in and wanting my kids to have the same opportunities to, you know, learn to fly fish in blue ribbon trout streams and have those opportunities that I've had. And so it's really out of just respect for this incredible world that I feel like I want to be part of helping to keep it healthy and do everything I can.
Marisol, thank you so much for this interview. It was really enlightening to hear how climate change increases fragility in the Arctic and what does that have to do with the rest of the world. Let's now summarize what we've talked about today. First, you explained the socioeconomic, the geographical, and the political context of the region. We also spoke about the climate in the Arctic and its tipping points. We've learned that they represent abrupt and potentially irreversible changes in the thresholds of the Earth's systems, at which an additional incremental change can result in a major shift in the state of the system, often accelerated by feedback loops, which is all quite scary if you ask me. In essence, this means that what happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. Then you've highlighted the following 7 climate fragility risks in the Arctic region. The first one, actorless threats like climate change will increasingly shape the global threat environment. The second risk, increased military activity in the Arctic may have unintended consequences. Risk number 3, climate change provides an avenue for China to strengthen its Arctic presence. Risk number 4, indigenous cultures and communities are disproportionately at risk. Risk number 5, shifting migration patterns are seen as a threat rather than an opportunity. Risk number 6, inadequate international risk mitigation efforts may increase the likelihood of geoengineering technology deployment on a unilateral basis. And risk number 7, increasing economic activity in the Arctic may fuel criminal opportunism.
You also explained how the fate of the Arctic is the fate of Miami and other low-lying areas, or in other words, how climate change in the Arctic affects regions around the world. We spoke about the geopolitical aspects and you highlighted that cooperation is strong and central. In recent years, countries are increasingly interested in the region because our understanding of the interconnections between the Arctic and other regions with regard to climate change becomes better researched. Regarding China, you explained the drivers of their interest in the region and how they leverage their investments to further their political aims. We also quickly discussed the region's role with regard to deterrence and military strike capabilities. You identified a few entry points how governments and policymakers could best address the compound climate and fragility risks. First, policymakers must understand the growing roles of actorless threats. Climate change is not occurring in a vacuum. We need to understand the interconnectedness of the different topics. Second, we must fill governance gaps in the region. Third, we need to deepen dialogues among Arctic states and other important security actors. Fourth, we must increase emergency response capabilities and develop more coordinated responses. Fifth, we need to support development in the Arctic and look at best practices for countering influence of bad actors. Sixth, we must engage indigenous knowledge from the very beginning. The biggest takeaway for me personally was the potential of the region to create positive change and promote environmental-friendly solutions. The Arctic shows us the convergence of all the issues of our time to understand that the status quo is not okay and that we need to act and create positive change. Marisol, thank you again for joining us today. It was a great pleasure to have you as our guest. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. You can reach us with questions and feedback on Twitter @ClimateDiplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye. Thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And please stay in touch if there's anything else you need.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much.
All right. All right, great. Take care.
See you soon. Bye.
See you soon. Bye-bye.